Welcome to the Lead Lifestyle podcast, where we believe every person can achieve their life goals as a result of their work, not in spite of it. We interview the best minds in the world so you can learn their philosophy, mindset, training methods, mental health advice, nutritional ethos, daily routines, and everything in between so you can optimize your lifestyle, reach peak physical health, and influence your team into high performance with you. So my guest today is Di Reece. Di is an expert in rugby performance. So just to name a few roles he's had, he's been head coach of Wales Sevens, assistant coach at Gwent Dragons, national coach for Hong Kong Rugby, chief rugby operations officer at the Hong Kong Rugby Union. So a ton of roles, but he coaches far more than just rugby. Di is a highly experienced coach of performance, strategy, and transformation within business. And he's now focused on helping individuals develop themselves fully through mentoring programs. So thanks for coming on, Di.
Yeah, it's great to be here, and thanks. Lovely introduction. And yeah, I've had a variety of roles over the years. Yeah, they've all been based around sport, but in latter years, as you highlighted, I've got into well-being, personal mentoring and coaching. And I think the leadership skills and coaching skills for many years in my younger days were seen as sports only. And as the modern world has opened up, I think the transferable skills within all environments, as you mentioned, business, sport, rugby, cricket, netball, whatever you mean, the core of it, the core leadership skills and coaching skills are generic and can be adapted within different platforms.
Yeah. Yeah, did you find when you went from coaching the national side to being the chief rugby operations officer, did you find that going into more of the business and operational side of things was a big difference?
It is a big difference. And I was fortunate when that happened to me in rugby that in another life, so to speak, I was a PE teacher, started life off as a PE teacher, and then did the usual driven, egotistical driven thing as a young man, worked my way up through the senior management spines within a college in South Wales, and was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time, head of faculty, and moved away from the chalk face, so to speak, and became a college principal or a campus director. I'd been lucky enough to have a journey from teacher, which is the love and passion of working with people, to senior management in a previous life, so to speak. So this is where this transfer of skills has become more and more evident. As I had the same journey in rugby, in sport, I used the same skills and indeed had to develop more and more skills as the world and the leadership skills opened up. It is a tough transition, but I was fortunate in Hong Kong that I'd had a fantastic journey in both the business world and the coaching world, the coaching and sports world before making that transition. But it is a very, very politically different journey, I would have to say.
What do you mean by that?
As you journey as a young sportsman, you know, I was... my journey as a coach, I guess I started coaching young men, young boys, from the age of 22 years, my age of 22 years old, because I was a teacher. So I was trained as a teacher. I was trained as a coach. I played. I continued to play for 10 to 15 years, actually, as a teacher, coach by day and a player by night, so to speak. And you just get on with it. You turn up. And you wear your heart on your sleeve. I was ambitious. I was egotistical to a certain extent on reflection, just wanting to achieve my goals and just playing the game. A young man, just a young boy, just wanting to fulfill his dream of playing for Wales one day. You then start to transition into the captaincy roles, where you need to become a leader. Again, I was fortunate enough to captain, you know, Newbridge and Newport, in what would have been the professional era in my time, but the first class era. And then straight away, you start to consider people around you. You start to consider the board members, the coaching staff, the different personalities within the team, you know, your leaders that will support you, your followers, you know, the terrorists even, or your mavericks. So you start to assess personalities as you go into different leadership roles. And then as you go up the leadership spine into senior management, and I call it away from the chalk face, meaning in both roles, I've moved away from teaching or coaching into senior management roles, where it becomes a very political environment where you try and, my leadership skill is an umbrella approach where I manage up and manage down. So I protect my team under me to do their roles and to do their jobs and create a psychologically safe space for my team to support performance, to make sure the players and the coaches are in good spaces. And I then in my role as COO in Hong Kong, or you know, head of performance, my role is to pass information up to the board levels, to educate them in the high performance platforms and what we are trying to achieve, and in the same respect to manage that information coming down the spine and to make sure that it's authentic and make sure that the key leaders within your team and also the players and the coaching staff are well informed of what the strategic direction of the board is or what the strategic direction of your CEO is. And I think my journey has been the communication, open communication creates transformational teams and transformational platforms and performance platforms, as opposed to the ones that I performed as a young man in my early days, which were more transactional, more tell. And so, yeah, a long way of answering it, but I think, you know, there's also the political spectrum that you have to consider as you move up the different levels of management and strategic management.
So it's more pragmatic, I suppose, on the players' level. They just need to know what to do and be given the space to do it. And then on the high level with the operational side, it's political in the sense that everyone has to understand the needs and the direction of the organisation and then feed that back to the players through the coaches.
Absolutely. I don't know how you found it working, you know, in sport management and developing your career. There's a desire out there for the players and coaches in high performance environments to, perhaps there's a lack of desire. They don't want to be concerned with what's going on in the boardroom. They want to understand, you know, how they get fed, how they get paid, and how they are being supported. And there are key areas of that, providing the hygiene, as I call it, to the performance squad so they can perform. Are they interested in the top end strategic direction of how the money comes in from sponsors? Not really. I wasn't as a player, I probably wasn't as a young coach. So that filtration of useful information from the senior end of it, the board level, the CEO, is critically important. And I think you need to anticipate what the performance team and what the information they require and what turns them on and keeps them maintained on the focus of their role. In the same respect, you know, the players and the coaching staff have to have an appreciation of how personal appearances and how sponsors are critical, and they can't shy away from their responsibilities with their contracts, which perhaps might not be playing, but it might be personal appearances and engaging at different levels to ensure that the relevant platforms are supported by the players and the coaching staff. In the same respect, you know, managing down, a lot of boards are massively in business oriented, massively enthusiastic. Do they understand the nitty gritty of how we put a performance together on the field? How many hours it takes of analysis? Or do they just see the drop pass or the result then, the win or the loss as an indicator of how well we are doing? It's important.
Have you seen The Last Dance, the Chicago Bulls documentary?
I have. It's a while ago, but
It's like their head coach, is it Phil Jackson? I don't want to say that name. the gist of it is the management in Chicago Bulls are going to get rid of, Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, like all the quality, star, like
Absolutely, yeah.
they're just recycling them. And so the coach has to go to the players and say, at the end of the season, whether you win or lose, we're out. And so
Yeah.
he's got to kind of get on with the management team, whilst also he had to come up with a completely separate vision for the players to get them engaged. And that's when the last dance, if this is the last time we're going to play, let's go out in a raging inferno of skill and class and excellence, and really engage them with that, because the alternative is, what's the point in playing the season for them?
And it's absolutely incredible, isn't it, to watch how the players follow the leader, follow the man that they played for. And you can argue that the board have made a strategic decision to freshen things up and anticipate that if we keep going this way, we'll just drop off the end of a cliff. But the loyalty that Jordan and the team then and the way they get themselves up, the honesty in it, is quite interesting when you watch it, how the hell they ever anticipated that journey would be there and filmed it all, and how they've put it together is fascinating, isn't it? But the loyalty and that's a great example, Ant, of what I'm trying to portray. It is important that the board and those people understand the hard work. So that is a strategic leader within the platform is my role, and that's where your role changes. It isn't going in and fighting and arguing with them. It's actually presenting, getting your senior coach, your senior captain to come into a board meeting and to say, this is what we're doing. This is what we do every week. And I found over the years that when you gain a lot of respect from the board and from your senior management team at the top level, when and they enjoy the game, they enjoy the environment more. They can engage at a different level with the players in the boardroom or after the match or when they're at sponsors events. So it works both ways. And I've seen that as my role in as an high performance strategic manager, both in education and in sport.
So moving kind of more towards what you're planning to do in the future, you spoke to me about the difference between being a coach and being a mentor. What do you think is the power of having a mentor, and how does that differ from simply having a coach?
I think this is a great question, and the reason that I did a formal course through the International Coaching Federation was to really, I've been seen as a mentor all my life, or you mentoring X, Y, and Z. Was I doing it well? I'm not sure whether I was, because I didn't really understand the difference, nuances between teaching, instructing, coaching, and mentoring. So get off your backside and learn a bit and get out there and do some courses. So the big thing for me, I was very instructional and transactional when I started in my role because I was a teacher. We teach, we instruct, we tell. And my journey then into more transformational over recent years has been through the understanding of the effect that questioning and coaching and mentoring does for you. So did I get angry when I was a young man? Yeah, I did. Did I think by telling people what to do and getting angry with them would make them perform better? We can come on to feedback models in a bit, but science tells us now negative feedback doesn't improve performance. Fact. It's not to say you haven't got to give negative feedback. So the mentoring coaching element of it, coaching is more generic, open-ended questions. And the easiest way to describe it to people who are not into it, mentors have an experience that they can guide and lend to the person in front of them or the team in front of them. A mentor as opposed to a coach. I can coach someone. I coach a couple of people. I know nothing about their subject here, nothing about their life, but I can open-ended question and take the question and get them to find the solution. So in a coaching session, and this is where I believe rugby's gone, sport's gone more in the modern era, where you're asking questions of the players, and it's their environment. They're going to be on the field to be able to instruct them constantly, which is where I was as a young coach. the coaching aspect of the modern game is about giving ownership. You hear of you know, Eddie Jones, and you hear of Warren Gatland and all the top coaches out there. They are more coaching and giving ownership to the players. That's coaching. That is coaching. Because and then as opposed to the mentoring, you just come in and mentor because you've been there in a World Cup final with Australia, and you can give mentor the and guide your players. So that's the big difference between coaching and mentoring and how I approach it now.
Yeah. I think that there's been several times in my own career as a coach and as a business owner that I don't think I could have appreciated the lessons I've gone through without hindsight. Like, no one could have ever told me at the start of my coaching career, you know, you need to listen to the head coach and do what they tell you, and never have your own ideas and blah, blah, blah. Because when you're 21, you're like, no, I'm not going to listen to that. I'm going to just, you know, argue and make my own points and cause a bit of a disruption. But then in hindsight, maybe I would have had a longer career in professional sport if I hadn't been so disruptive, you know. And then that led me to start my own business. And then when you're young and have your own business, doesn't matter what anyone tells you, you think that you're right. You're just going to do it your own way, at least for me anyway. And then that leads to, you know, failure. And then you learn from that. And then eventually the pain leads you to ask for help. And then the help, you know, for me was in the form of a mentor, somebody who's done what I want to do and just guided me along the way. Do you think you can fast track that process? Or do you think it's something you have to do?
I sort of anticipate what you're going to say. Yeah, and for me, that happened a lot quicker for you. You're a lot younger man, and I'm smiling when you're taking me through your journey. I was exactly the same. I think it's the masks of masculinity. It's the masculine approach to anything. You're conditioned as young men. You're conditioned as young kids, particularly in certain upbringings and backgrounds, not to show vulnerability as men. And you know, power is doing your own thing and actually not accepting help. And if you accept help, you're being weak. So let's you know, steer our own ship and fail and all, pick yourself up. Well, if you're strong like you've obviously been, and I haven't been, I've been strong on many, many occasions, but there's been times when I haven't been able to be strong as well. And I haven't been able to pick myself up, and I've required my wife or my close friends or my family to pick me up when I've had huge disappointment. So there's times when we tend to learn on, men tend to learn by masculine. And the biggest learning curve I've had in my 50s is what is wrong with asking for help. What is wrong in, like, I'm sitting and we're talking about ideas as a young, and what is that wrong with me asking an older man experience and help? And it, I don't know, there's something in Western society that says it, you know, steer your own ship. Well, the great mentors and leaders in the world today, they've got support teams around them, they've got mentors, they've got friends, they've got people they talk to. So I'm massive now. My biggest transition is just get on. And again, I'm a boomer. I got three Gen Z kids. You know, we didn't have the internet. So, you know, you had to get a book or you had to go and have a beer with a mate. So it wasn't something that you did. But now I'm connecting with you today. I can connect with friends in Australia and New Zealand and have those conversations. Use the Gen Z, the connectivity, the media, the social media in a positive way to learn. And to gain experience. So that's a great question, but and your journey is very typical, I believe, of men, to say.
Yeah. I'm reading a book at the moment called Sapiens. I'm not sure if you read that, but it's a history of humans, Homo sapiens, from, you know, prehistory up to the modern day, and then some predictions for the future. Yeah. And it's saying that you can't have order within a society without having an imaginary overarching belief for everyone to kind of get behind. Yeah. Otherwise, you just would be out for yourself all the time. But where it differs culturally in the West, as opposed to the East, is that in the West, we're brought up to be individuals and we've all got our own special gift to give to the world and no one can stop us. But it compares that with medieval society where you wouldn't even have your own bedroom. You'd be in a, you know, a lodge room with like 20 other blokes and, you know, from rugby and in the military, you know, it becomes very clear who's a bit of a dick and who's, you know, all right to be around when you're all living on top of each other. So then you're not an individual, you're in a hierarchy. And I think that it just is a very interesting book to open your mind to these imaginary beliefs and to zoom out and go, actually, you know, where am I going with my own
development? Absolutely, Ben. And it's a lovely... A lovely analogy that I've come across in a little story here that you know, I've been fortunate enough to travel. And I spent in more recent times when I was in Hong Kong, I spent a lot of time down in Fiji because we linked up with Fiji. The Hong Kong Sevens is a special place for the Fijians. They have a national holiday when they win it. And I was fortunate enough, obviously, to coach with Gareth Baber, who's their current coach, and will take them through to the Olympics. And so I had some special times. I'd take the teams down and we would make sure we went out to the villages. Incredible, absolutely incredible. People think the Fijian, you know, Fiji's just got to turn up. Well, those guys, there'll be guys in the Olympics who've never been out of Fiji, never been out of their small village, no electric, no running water. And then they're in front of 40, 50,000 at stadiums playing sevens, the game they love. But the point you make, so we were fortunate enough to train at training camps and exactly the same as you describe in the book, the Fijians have a lodge. They absolutely cannot deal with being on their own. So they will come in on a Monday morning to the lodge right on the sea where we trained with them. And they all stay together in one, I can't remember the Fijian term for it, but it's basically a lodge where the 20 of them are sleeping on low beds on the floors and living together. And that culture makes them what they are, and I believe makes them high performance athletes, you know. And then they really struggle when I speak to them and meet up with them in Hong Kong, the bustle and bustle of the city, and then they have the room in a plush, what we would all in Western terms love to be in, a double room, you know, great amenities. They end up sleeping on each other's floor, but that's what makes them tick. So you'd have, I've known in the bedrooms in Hong Kong, four or five Fijians just chilling out and sleeping in the same room. So really, really resonate with that. I haven't read the book, but that's one of the cultures that I can really see benefit from it. And it's their upbringing. It's what makes them tick.
Yeah. It makes me think like, would I be a different guy if I hadn't played rugby for so long and, you know, been in that team environment? I think naturally I like being by myself, but also I have enjoyed being in business masterminds or going to conferences and having that, you know, concentrated period of learning and connecting and having my own kind of ego broken down a little bit and then going back to my own shed, if you like, being creative and being isolated. I do like both approaches.
How would you describe yourself, Ant? Would you describe yourself as an introvert, extrovert? Where would you be on the personality scale?
That's a brilliant question. I always thought I was an extrovert because I'm quite a loud person, but I've read that it's been defined as whether you're energized by being around other people or whether it drains your energy. And I found that whether this is as I've got older or I've just got more self-awareness, I do get drained by being around other people. I'd say I'm a very confident introvert. I've just got to be quite strategic with how I do it. And I've done the Myers-Briggs. I don't know how accurate you think that is, but I come out as a INFJ. So it's that introverted, intuitive, feeling, judging, which is quite a rare one, apparently. And it was on this website called 16personalities.com. It's really good. And it said that my specialty in life would be being an advocate. So, you know, doing a podcast would be good. Doing public speaking would be good. Even though I'm introverted, what is my area of meaningful work is actually getting behind a message and pushing it out to people, despite my own conversion.
That's fantastic. One little question. There was a bit of coaching going on there from me. The one little question, and I discovered your self-awareness is fantastic. And how easy was that for me as a coach or a strategic manager to understand that? And you know, your self-awareness is fantastic because you've looked at it. And I've sort of got a little framework that I'm working through and, you know, we'll share over the next few weeks on LinkedIn, you know, the part of the journey as a coach and as a high performance athlete or a strategic manager is self-awareness. It's massive. And one of the areas you've mentioned, Myers-Briggs, but is understanding your personality trait. What are you? And interestingly, I describe you as what I am, which is an introverted extrovert. So, and what I mean by that is that by my nature, I'm like you. I'm introverted, but my role and my job all my life has been an extroverted role, whether it's in coaching, high performance. So if I said I was an introvert to most of my friends and colleagues that I've worked with over the last 40 years, they go, "Don't be so soft. You must be kidding me." But the reality of it is it exhausts me. So in those high performance leadership roles, and even as a teacher, when I get home, absolutely blown away. Or if I was on a 7-circuit trip, I'd be wiped out after 6 or 7 days. And then one thing to mention during our chat is for me, it's been discovering my restorative niche. And my restorative niche is finding a little bit, like you said, is finding what energizes you and what allows you to recover. I love being around people. I love being a team player. I love the energy that's created in a team environment and building teams. I also know then, I need to find a quiet, meditative, and I didn't know that as a young man. I'd just go out and party. I'd go out and enjoy myself, and then I drain them. But now I need to walk, cold water swim, exercise, just discover that restorative niche that I must have before I start another week. And if you can relate that to more sports environments and senior management roles. It's great, that is. That little question, and just offer that up as well to the listeners that look for your restorative niche and really investigate what you are as a personality.
So if I was an extrovert, could the restorative niche be calling a friend and having a chat? Like, is that the...
Is it yeah, first... so... So I love my stories, as you'll discover, and I think it's one of the leadership traits. But a lovely story in rugby that happened to me, to colleagues recently. So you've got the analyst for Hong Kong, who's an extrovert. So he's flat out, loves it, loves life, gets out, has a fantastic time, not just a beer, but enjoys himself. So he's an extrovert, always talking, loves it. And then when you're out with him, energized. Our SNC sports scientist is an introverted in an extroverted role. I happened to shout at boys, motivate boys. So they were in training and they had about a kilometer walk between the coaching platform and the training ground. So think of the two jobs. So it's being led now by the SNC guy, by Jordan. And he's got 32 high performance athletes on the field, and he's drilling them, and this is an hour. So he's the introvert, and his energy levels are up again. He's out of his natural zone, natural habitat, so to speak. You've got Sparky, who's up on the gantry on his own in isolation, who's an extrovert for the hour. So, of course, the session finishes. They both come down together and they've got a kilometre walk back to the office. Sparky, being an extrovert, that's all he wants to, and he's been on his own for an hour, that's all he wants to do is talk and yapper, and his energy levels are high. Jordan, who's an introverted extrovert, just wants quiet. So as they're going back, they end up nearly having a fight because Jordan's just wanting quiet. Sparky's talking and just by the two of them understanding, and he said, "Will you just shut up or go and find someone else to talk to?" My point of the story is that if you don't understand and you're not self-aware, that could end up in a clash. You've probably been in high performance environments where an introvert and an extrovert unknowingly, the introvert has wanted his restorative niche of quiet and the extrovert just wants to talk and have a cup of coffee and a cup or get out and do something active. So that understanding, and this is where I believe the key going forward is the building of the teams as well, your performance teams, and of your coaching team in particular. Well, you need a more, incidentally, you need every one of these in your team, I think. Someone to calm you down, someone to motivate you. So the dynamic, and again, it became very, very obvious when we started to look at restorative niches. We really understood the dynamics of our leadership team and our coaching team, which is vital. Not sure if that answers your question, but
really interesting. I mean, it wasn't really a question there. It's just nice to hear you kind of lay it out like that, because it's really, really simple example to understand. So imagine that team environment, but in an office building, you know, COVID and remote working aside, let's just say everyone working full-time in an office. How could a leader of a team of, let's say, 30 people who would be much more diverse than a rugby team, how can you determine each person's?
It's interesting. That's an interesting comment in itself. From you said it would be much more diverse than a rugby team. In actual fact, I think they're very comparable. So it's just that they are different environments, different habitats. And as a rugby player, and I can say it as an older man now, I would have thought exactly the same as you. Most rugby players are very similar. Or is it that we actually adhere to the norm of a rugby environment? So this is the struggle in high performance that I've had when I've looked at this and wellbeing and introducing it to a traditional rugby platform. And I say, we've got to look at every personality. And you'll get some, and you've got to look at their traits. And if the more understanding we've got of each other, the more likely we are to perform as a team. The reality of it is, I've had a lot of rejection from that. They got to adhere to what we want. Well, really? When they're conditioning as young men, they've been brought up with their mums and dads, with their teachers, they are introverted. You need to consider he's introverted. It doesn't mean he's a bad player. And so over the years, a lot of coaches basically put their personality and try to change and adjust players to play, and that's transactional. That's not transformational. That's not allowing the players and the coaching staff to express and to be themselves and be authentic. That's enforcing. It works, but it only works for a certain length of time. It wins World Cups, yep, and then you probably recycle. Is that right or wrong? I'm not sure. So how does a business look at it? In exactly the same way. I think both rugby, high performance sport, the management and leadership teams that actually look at the core values that exist within their team instead of forcing the core values of the organization onto them, is the team that has a happy transformational. And the key element to anyone working in the team is a sense of belonging. And how do we as leaders or coaches create a sense of belonging? That's asking questions, listening, and actually showing your employees or your players or your coaching team that you care and connecting at a different level. How's mum and dad? How's the baby this morning? How's your wife doing? You've gone through some tough times. What's going on? Actually connecting at that humanistic level rather than just being distant as a leader. It takes a lot of time, a lot of energy, and a lot of commitment as leaders and coaches. But I think it's the key moving forward in today's society where the digital age has taken that connection away. And I think as leaders now, we've got to bring it back into team environments. And I think it's the most successful businesses out there that do that are the ones that will continue to achieve and look after the well-being of their staff.
Yeah, I've read something interesting by Simon Sinek, and he said trust is what happens in between the meetings. It's not, you know, let's talk business, you know, on a Zoom call, it's whilst we're walking down the corridor to get to the meeting room, those little chats you have about life with your colleagues, that's what will build the team environment.
Yeah.
Remote working could, well, it is removing that, unless you're all going to do things like a virtual lunch or, you know, just phone people to see how they are for a couple of minutes each week. I think it's important to have that human element and consciously think quite tactically about how you can actually deploy that. Fergie's book's really good. Fergie's book on leadership, where it's like his whole career was basically getting to know his players so deeply that he knew who was firing when, and then he put all those people together and they went and, you know, it was all team selection and understanding.
And yeah, it's that energy, isn't it? I think, yeah, he was an expert at it, wasn't he? You know, love players, if you read books of the different players in him, love him or hate him, or he did know people, didn't he? His big trait was, I don't know what he was like as a technical coach, but he certainly understood how people operate, how his team operated, and how his the feelings, I guess, knowing their emotions, and knowing when they would perform. And I think, again, what someone who I've come across, you know, in rugby, and he's going to take the Lions away. Warren Gatland has got this incredible knack. He might not be the best technical coach in the world. I'm not sure. I haven't coached under him, but people say his trait is he can put a team on the field that functions. You know, that when he dropped Driscoll for Jamie Roberts, it caused absolute murder. He did it based on a feeling and something that was right for the team. And I think those kind of coaches are out there. And it's got to be the way forward for not just sports teams, but I think for high performance in business as well.
Yeah. Oh, man, I'm looking forward to the Lions tour. That's all I think about at the moment.
It's strange, isn't it? I mean, the media's building up now, and this is why I brought it up, because I'm smiling in that, you know, I read an article this morning, the 10 players outside the current Six Nations, and Simmons, you know, down in Exeter, you know, who had a great game on the weekend again. And it was just talking about those 10, and I'm just smiling, and Gatland will, I think he'll throw a few curveballs in there. I think he will pick players that, you know, that are being written off by the media purely based on knowing their traits and knowing what he wants in the dynamic of a 36-man squad. And it won't just be how they performed and the statistics and data. It'll be the man they are, the people they are to that group. And, yeah, it will. If you read all the articles at the moment, and I got about 60 or 70 players in the mix at the moment, and then you listen to the commentators on BT Sport, and then you can put another 20 in. So there's some real, and it's great because Gatland will have his, he'll have his 30, he'll only be the six outside that now he's looking at. So interesting times and really looking forward to it.
Yeah, I think really good year for British rugby. I'll just ask one more question, mate, and then I think let's wrap it up. If what I'm going to do is basically work mainly in corporate environments, I'm going to ask you like a corporate type question. Let's say there's someone who's late 30s and they're going into an executive role and they're gaining more self-awareness and they're realizing that they were micromanaging and being transactional and they want to become more transformational. What can they do to learn those skills and then practically apply it?
Listen and question. Don't tell. Transformation is about holding space, listening, giving your staff and your management team space to talk, and don't interrupt. That's one of my most difficult, well, it was one of my most difficult transitions, to just hold space and listen and let them finish. So that is a critical element of that transformational journey. And then ask questions, you know, open-ended questions to explore what the the member staff wants and what they're all about. So for me, it would be those two key elements: listening and asking questions. Now, that sounds obvious, doesn't it? I'm just thinking myself, thinking on my feet here. I'm that doesn't really tell someone who's listening. I don't know. What do you think?
I think if I could share something, I was talking to a management team about physical health, mental health, and this, you know, what you're suggesting. Ask more questions, get to know them. And that they didn't want to ask the questions because they didn't want to have to be the person responsible for saying, you know, well, actually, you need some help with mental health and I don't know how to help you. And I was saying to them, it's okay to not know how to help them, but it's not okay to not know that they need help. You're the connector between their problem and a resource to empower them. So, you know, if they need a blood test to find out if they're diabetic,
absolutely,
get a doctor. You know, if they need help with their psyche, put them in touch with a therapist or someone they can talk to and have some counseling. And if that was the modern workplace, that's what I'm trying to push, then I think it would be a much more human place to be.
Absolutely. And again, it comes nice. This is all you've given me that sort of light bulb moment there, in that it's that caring element, isn't it? You know, it's the question that has been asked a few times, you know, do you want to be liked as a leader or do you want to be respected? And most people, when you ask that, think they need to say respected, or they feel they need to be respected on it. Well, I'd ask you that question. What would your answer be, Anne, to that? Liked or respected?
I probably would have said respected.
Yeah, and mine is liked, because I think you connect, and I think when I say this, hopefully you'll reflect on it. If you're liked and connect with a person, you'll become respected, and then your actions are more transformational. So it's another technique of to a business. The challenge would be to be liked rather than ignoring, so to get to know people. So the connection results in getting to know a person, and then you can. And I did a lovely little story told by someone who you know, Dean Ryan, and he said it hit home to him when he worked with a client. They were working in a prison. And the guy said, yeah, I'm going to go in. I want to be respected. I'm going to go in hard. He said this to one of the inmates, and he said, oh, you just do that. He said, they'll show you what hard is. So he completely reversed his thought process. He went in, he got to connect with them, he got liked by them, and then they started to work with him. And I thought that was a lovely analogy of, you go in, and then if it goes pear-shaped, mind, when you go in hard and it goes pear-shaped, then look at what happens. There's no way out then, is there? So it's like, and I've been in some situations where I've worked with senior managers that are just going and tell them, be really hard. Staff haven't responded and they've lost their staff from point one. I think respect comes from being liked. You've got to still be yourself. You still got to have your framework. But I really do, I'd like to reverse that trend. And I think that another thing is, for your leaders, your business leaders, that's transformational coaching or transformational leadership. The other one is that I challenge all leaders to have a philosophy. So, you know, what is your leadership philosophy? What is your coaching philosophy? I wrote an article on LinkedIn recently, which goes into that in some depth. And when you're in a leadership role and you're interviewing people, you'd be amazed at how many people stumble and stutter when you say, okay, so what is your coaching philosophy? Okay, so what is your leadership philosophy? They can't answer it. They're not clear, crystal clear on that they're a humanistic leader, that they, you know, they want their staff to feel rewarded, they want, et cetera, et cetera. They haven't sat down and reflected on how they want to be seen. So again, that article asks four questions. How would you want to be remembered as a leader? How do you think people see you as a leader? So there's a series of questions on there that would actually start to question what your philosophy or my philosophy is in leadership or coaching. Just again, transformational ask yourself those questions. And if you are clear on them, then you portray that energy and model those behaviors.
Yeah, I think going back to what you said about mentoring and what I'm teaching with the physical health and having, you know, a barrier between work and life so that you can recharge and focus more when you're at work. Putting yourself through those personal development kind of processes means that you can more likely be in a position where you can mentor your staff or your team to do that and be a role model. And it, you know, like you said, be liked by not just asking them to do it, but showing that you're walking the path with them as well.
And the word there that comes to mind immediately is empathy. You're an empathetic leader. You understand, because you understand the way they feel, the way they react, transformational. If you show empathy to someone who's had a new baby and they are late nights and you say, listen, guys, listen, fella, you know, have Friday off. You look great. You look shattered. Spend some time at home with the new baby. The reward that comes from having that empathy and understanding as a leader is just, it's just massive. It's just, and I've done it. I've done it. I've said, get out of work. You need to go and see the missus, drive the 2 hours, 3 hours you need to go and spend the next 4 days with the newborn. The respect, years later, you know, one particular lad who I worked with in Hong Kong and Australia, and he said, you know what, Dad, we've been working together 10 years, and he said, the one thing that you did for me, you told me to fly home to see my wife, and he said, it just sticks with me, that from that point you had me. From that point I knew that I was always going to be working with you, and I didn't have any idea I was doing it. But that's, again, an example of transformational empathy for me as a leader is key.
Yeah. Well, I'll leave you with a story that will probably make you feel really old now.
I am old.
When I was at Abu Ghibani, I think it was under 15s, we had David Rawalui came down and Percy Montgomery. I guess you must have been coaching around them around that
time. I know Percy well. I coached him at the Dragons.
And David Rowe was on a tackle bag, and we were all running at him as hard as we could, trying to move him. And it was like running to a brick wall.
Yeah.
But he was such a friendly, like, happy guy. And then Percy Montgomery was there in his, like, shined up boots and like, and, you know, like, faded jeans. And he was trying to do all these grubber kicks, and it wasn't working because he had all these slippery shoes on. But, you know, I always remember that, you know, they weren't bigger than the game. They came back and they, you know, they helped, you know, local clubs, and it was awesome. And I always thought, you know, whatever I do, I want to be like that and go back and help people. So if you had a part in that, mate, I just want to say thanks. It was awesome.
Yeah, two amazing characters, and one, you know, great coach now, and just again that Fijian background, Simon, that humble. Like you said, he stood on the bags. You could have hit him as hard as you possibly wanted. What a top man. And Percy, as you say, contrast to Safa, you know, and a rock star. And he was a rock star at that time of his life. And then he went back and he got back in 100 caps and he became the first or the second, him and Matfield, the first two to get century caps for Australia, for South Africa. But hell of a character, you know. And as you say, perhaps the last of those of that era that were world stars that, you know, kept giving back constantly without any thought for themselves or others. But two fantastic characters, but contrasts and upbringing contrasts as well. Conditioning, you know, as young men, village in Fiji, private boys school in South Africa, bit of a difference.
Yeah, but, you know, I think that's a good example of the transformational side of things. And let's leave it there, mate. That's plenty to go through today for the...
Yeah.
Really good. Appreciate it, mate. And just to finish on, where can people find out more about you and your coaching philosophy?
Well, at the moment, you know, I'm transitioning myself. I'm looking around for opportunities. So at the moment, I've got a coach. Like, going back to our chat and part of the chat today, you know, I've reached out to a couple of friends that have been business coaching. So I'm just profiling myself a little bit through my LinkedIn profile. I'm on there as Di Rees, and I'm releasing articles, and I tend to be a bit old-fashioned in that I use Facebook as well for well-being posts. So it's my Facebook, and mostly, you know, within business, my LinkedIn profile would be where you can find some articles. One that we've discussed today, just going to do a couple more on values and values based recruitment, and also one that I released recently, which is liked or respected, and trying to get some discussion around that, which we've had today. But I'd just like to thank you, Ant, for the opportunity. Really enjoyed our chat, and hopefully I will have impacted some leaders and coaches out there. And it's been a real pleasure to be on your podcast. Good luck with everything.
No, definitely, mate. I really enjoyed it as well. It's been really good.